Hear ye, the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have a special hearing this morning, as you all are aware. 04-2559-W, State of Wisconsin, ex rel. Ralph Nader and Peter Camajo versus Circuit Court for Dane County. First, I'd like to state on behalf of the court that we appreciate that there are stringent time limits here, that the Board of Election had to act within a short time, that the Circuit Court had to act in a short time, and counsel had to prepare briefs in a short time, and the court has had a short time in which to act. And we appreciate your courtesies and your promptness in acting. As to the amicus brief, the court has accepted this brief. I think you were advised yesterday evening about that. The amicus brief is by the Republican Party. An issue arose. The amicus asked for time to speak at oral argument, and we traditionally have not accorded amicus an opportunity to speak at oral argument, and we followed that usual procedure today, and no one seemed anxious to yield any time to the Republican Party, so we are here with other speakers. There was a request the record be supplemented by a transcript of the State Board of Election. We asked for a response to that request by other counsel. There was opposition to that by Attorney Pines. The court received the transcript not at 6 o'clock, as originally proposed by counsel, but closer to 10:30. It was also transmitted by email to all counsel at that time. Members of court have copies of that transcript, and as counsel were advised, the court will take that transcript under advisement and has not ruled on a receipt. I think that covers the matters that have been handled in the last few hours through electronic devices. So we have three attorneys arguing here, and the court would like the attorneys to address various issues they see, but the court would like you to talk about the procedure by which this case is here. There seems to be some dispute as to whether it's an original action, whether it's a writ, maybe it's a bypass in disguise. You should characterize it and would advise you to tell the court what difference does it make as to the scope or nature of the court's review, depending on the nature of the procedure. We'd also like to know whether the circuit court has entered a final order or that the transcript is the of the proceedings that we have are the only things that are before us. In addition to the procedural issue, of course, the court would like you to discuss the interpretation of the statute, the main statute in issue, and the other statutes. So we will start with Attorney Bernhoft and then Attorney Balestrieri. They will share the 25 minutes. We'll make it 30 minutes, so each of you get approximately 15 minutes. Mr. Pines will have 35 as a result of that. And then Mr. Bernhoft will do a rebuttal. The court always reserves the right to extend oral argument by its questions, as you know, although we would hope you would adhere to the red lights since decision has to be made also. You should not feel compelled to use all your time. It's within your discretion. All right. Are there any questions? Hearing none, I will call on Robert G. Bernhoft, Attorney Bernhoft, representing Ralph Nader. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. This matter is before the Court on Ralph Nader and Peter Miguel Cameo's petition for leave to commence an original jurisdiction action in this Court, Publici Juris. The questions presented by the petition are indeed of great public import and exigency. We are all aware of the time deadlines for printing and mailing absentee ballots, and some of those deadlines indeed trigger this coming Saturday, October 2nd, and this coming Sunday, October 3rd. I appreciated the opportunity and the Chief Justice's admonition to address the question of the procedural posture of this case, and indeed it is quite significant, particularly for Mr. Nader and Mr. Cameo. I also appreciated the Court's advisement that there have been time constraints, and the Court will know that we walked our petition for leave to commence an original jurisdiction action over to the Court several minutes after the Circuit Court rendered its ruling. And with respect to that ruling, we are unaware of any final written order in that matter. There was brief discussion after the bench ruling on the 28th, and it was agreed by the parties that an oral ruling from the Circuit Court bench was indeed binding. We are unaware if the Circuit Court has issued a final written order codifying its bench ruling.
Counsel, do you mean by that the parties agreed that the oral order or the oral order as transcribed, in the transcript that we have received, was contemplated by the Court and the parties to be the appealable order in this case?
Yes, Justice Bradley, indeed. And there is authority for the proposition that the oral bench ruling of a Circuit Court judge constitutes a final order for purposes of final decision, particularly on a temporary restraining order, which was the characterization that the Circuit Court gave.
Counselor, though, in the transcript it says that counsel for the Democratic Party is to prepare an order and submit it to the Court for its consideration within 3 days, so it doesn't sound to me like the transcript was to be the final.
Yes, Justice Roggensack, what occurred there is the Court was ready to adjourn, and at that point I requested leave to make a request to the Court. I requested that the Court stay execution of its writ of prohibition and to grant ancillary injunctive relief to my clients, restraining and enjoining the Election Board from making any certification, and the Court granted that provisionally until noon yesterday. And so we did indeed see a proposed order from Respondent's counsel at table, but it, to my knowledge, was never presented to the Court or executed and signed because the Court's order differed fundamentally from that contemplated before I made my request for injunctive relief.
Well, Mr. Bernhoff, are you still maintaining that you're asking this Court now to exercise its original jurisdiction?
Yes, Justice Crooks. And the authority for that is I think the most illuminating case on the original jurisdiction of this Court is In re Heil, a case that this Court has cited to on a number of occasions. And it's important to note that this Court has three forms of jurisdiction: appellate, supervisory, sometimes called superintending, and original. And the distinctions are important because these authorities are granted by the Constitution, as interpreted by the decisions of this Court. In re Heil, the function of the original jurisdiction of this Court, it is a transcendent, in the words of some of the opinions of this Court, a transcendent jurisdiction has been referred to as the body armor of the people's sovereignty. It's in the discretion of the Court to allow an original jurisdiction action to commence. And there are certain criteria.
Well, your opposing counsel cites the same case and basically says that case stands for the proposition that you can't invoke the original jurisdiction once the circuit court has acted, and or the trial court, if you will. How do you respond to that, sir?
The authorities simply do not support that assertion. And that was listed at page 3 of the respondent's filing with this court. In Heil, for example, they cite to a case, State Ex Rel Barber v. Circuit Court, 178 Wiss, 468. And quoting from the Heil opinion briefly, that matter was already pending in the circuit court, and no objection had even been made to the jurisdiction of that court to try the action. Nonetheless, the case had to do with nomination of a party ticket, and it was necessary to decide the case before election. It was held that the matter was of sufficient importance to call for the exercise of the original jurisdiction, and that it could not be disposed of by the circuit court and appealed to this court in time for final judgment to be of any practical effect. And this is extremely significant. Here's a case, State Ex Rel Barber v. Circuit Court, cited in Petition of Heil, that specifically shows an instance where this court, with an action of the same subject matter, having been commenced in the circuit court, this court indeed took up original jurisdiction, suspended the proceedings of the circuit court, took that matter in the first instance, not even in a sort of appellate de novo review. Exclusive original jurisdiction is a first instance determination by this court, and the authorities uniformly support that. There is no contra authority.
Counsel, I have a question. Why couldn't this court treat this as a bypass? Assuming the court has the jurisdiction, in other words, as I understand it, you're challenging what happened down in the circuit court, and you're asking us basically to reverse that. Why couldn't we take this as an emergency petition to bypass?
Yes, Justice Wilcox, we did not file this as a bypass, yeah. And although there's...
Well, under liberal, let's say, construction and liberal pleading rules, I think we could construe it as a bypass, couldn't we?
I don't think so, because the procedural rules in Chapter 809 of the Wisconsin statutes contain some very specific deadline and triggers for petitions for bypass. And the triggers for filing a petition for bypass are the operation of certain deadlines and briefing schedules. And when you look at that, now, it's not for me to suggest whether this court has discretion to apply or not to apply those procedural rules, but I would respectfully suggest that the procedural rules do not permit that. I also urge the court to consider petitioner's or plaintiff's choice, which is a doctrine that's been enforced in effect for several hundred years. We would urge the court to liberally construe our petition as a petition for leave to commence an original action.
What's the difference, Counselor? What's the difference if we construe this as a petition to bypass and we look at the issue you ask us to look at on the merits, or if we construe it as a petition for original jurisdiction and we look at the merits? What's the difference?
It's incredibly significant, Justice Roggensack. And what I'm going to do is very briefly quote from the Heil decision, and this is at the core of our request for remedy. We do not believe that the court can grant Mr. Nader or Mr. Kameo effective remedy unless indeed this court accepts this application for original jurisdiction action. And this quotation will make it very clear. It'll be brief. I'm loath to quote from cases, but again, it's been expedited briefing. When this court, in the exercise of its judgment and discretion, grants an application to commence an original action in this court upon grounds publici juris, for a speedy and authoritative determination by this court in the first instance, and here's the critical passage, this court then takes exclusive jurisdiction of the action, and that in aid of this jurisdiction, it may exclude, set at naught, and suspend any action or proceeding in any circuit court involving the same subject matter.
And Mr. Bernhoff, you just indicated earlier that the action in the circuit court, according to the parties, is done. So what is there to suspend?
What we are asking under that language, we are requesting an order vacating and voiding the entire circuit court proceeding. And that authority is expressly in the case law, and that provides our clients with their remedy. Because indeed, if the Dane County Circuit proceeding is set aside and voided by this court, then even if mandamus does not lie, which according to Farm Labor Party, it may not, against the Elections Board for a discretionary act, then, as Judge Nowakowski observed, once the injunction lifted that he issued, the board would proceed to discharge its statutory duty based on its original decision that Nader and Camejo should be on the ballot. So the precise remedy that we're asking this court to give us is to set aside and void the entire Dane County Circuit Court proceeding based on petition of Heil, Barber v. Circuit Court, and determine this matter in the first instance. Having determined that matter, the board will execute its original determination, which was thoughtful, reasonable, and a good exercise of discretion.
Counsel, then I want to make sure that I understand your position. The first question I asked you, and it was just picked up by Justice Butler, was whether or not the proceedings in the circuit court were final. And I understood your answer to be, yes, it constitutes a final appealable order. And so in order for us, since that's done, usually I think of original jurisdiction, meaning we deal with it originally. Well, it's not only been presented, it not only was pending, it's been finalized in the circuit court. So in order for us to get original jurisdiction, we've got to wipe out, void what happened in the circuit court. Otherwise, we cannot have original jurisdiction, given that it was completed in the circuit court. Is that correct?
I would respectfully take issue with that characterization.
Need your help with that.
Yes.
There
are cases where the court can accept original jurisdiction where the circuit court retains concurrent jurisdiction.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not talking about the pending case. You cite Heil, which was pending. What I'm focusing on and what my first question focused on this morning was the fact that it was completed in the circuit court. It was final. So keep that in mind, if you will, counsel.
I will. And I think that although there was a final TRO order, for lack of a better way to characterize it, the court issued some equitable relief, a variety of equity relief, state execution of a writ, granted ancillary injunction. But my understanding is that that circuit court still retains jurisdiction, and that indeed, if some of the parties to the litigation did not perform acts prescribed, that litigants could pursue remedy in that court. So to my mind, that action is not concluded, and the circuit court retains jurisdiction at least and until this court makes a determination to invoke its exclusive original jurisdiction.
What authority do you have that the circuit court retains jurisdiction after it has issued a final and appealable order in this case?
I would invoke general principles of jurisdiction and equity. Let's say that parties come before a court and there is a TRO order that commands somebody to do something or refrains a party from doing something, and that's not done. The remedy is to petition with a motion to show cause why that person shouldn't be held in contempt. And that's the sort of continuing jurisdiction I'm referring to. And I think the cases are replete with examples of litigants having the right to go back to that first entertaining court and enforce the orders of the court. In the school desegregation cases, Brown v. Board and its progeny, those district and appellate courts retained jurisdiction for decades and were the a proper place to go for remedy with respect to enforcing their judicial orders.
What facts do we accept as true if this is an original action?
None. This court is empowered and entitled to review everything as a first impression matter in the first instance. Now, sometimes there will be a writ of procedendo where the court will put it back down to the trial court where there's disputed facts. This case is particularly amenable to invoking exclusive original jurisdiction and setting aside as void the circuit court proceeding and determining the matter on the merits because the facts are not in dispute. It is not disputed that the nomination papers of Nader and Camejo had irregularities in the words of Algren. These were directory irregularities. That is not in dispute. The board conducted a hearing. The respondents were represented by able counsel. Counsel argued for Nader and Camejo. They discussed it for 2 hours. And the principal areas of discussion were, does this board have discretion to declare that the paper substantially complied? The transcript, the whole proceeding was dominated by that question. And so the idea of substantial compliance and discretion were absolutely paramount in the argument that took place before the board. In fact, board members queried each other back and forth. They queried board counsel. They queried the chairman, Mr. Kennedy of the board, asking, do we have discretion here? Judge Mize appeared by teleconference, and that was his question. Is there something here as a matter of law that requires us to bar Nader and Kamau from the ballot, something in the statute. And, of course, Judge Mize voted against these motions to preclude Nader and Kamau from the ballot. So these questions were bandied about. There was substantial discussion. And when you look at the board's decision, it's eminently reasonable. And I would turn
to where in the transcript do you find the standard that was relied upon by the board, however? I know it was discussed, but where do you find what they relied upon?
The seminal question was, do we have discretion or not? Four board members on this issue took the position that the board did not have discretion to determine substantial compliance, and five did. That was the overriding, overarching tenor and discussion at the board meeting. So it was,
as I understood the question that was posed to the people on the board, it was whether or not Nader should be on or off the ballot.
Yes, and well, the board, most of the board members are attorneys, and the board itself is highly specialized. They have technical expertise. It's a very specialized board. And Counsel Dunst for the Elections Board drafted a very thoughtful, comprehensive memo, which has been attached to the Attorney General's filing. And Counselor Dunst advised the board that these were directory provisions, that the board had discretion. And so
I understand the advice that they received, but my question is a little bit more fundamental. Where does it say what the board relied upon as its standard in making its determination? I mean, the only thing that we seem to have before us that gives us any indication is the letter order that came out.
Yes, Justice Butler, that's well taken. I would point to the fact it's a specialized board. They don't have an administrative law judge. They don't set out findings of fact and conclusions of law, and they actually take votes on motions to make determinations. It's a very summary, expedited proceeding. So you don't have the typical administrative agency with an ALJ with adversarial argument and counsel, exchange of documents or discovery, argument, briefing, and then a full-blown decision. What you have is the discussions that the board members had. And even if we construe this as a review, which it is not in our view, principles of administrative law, the court should search for any reason to find a reasonable, legitimate basis for the decision of the board.
What's the scope of review of the board generally? Is it 227.57?
The standard of review can vary depending on the question presented before the agency.
Okay, that's the same thing. Are you relying on 227.57 if there was review of the administrative agency?
Yes, if indeed, if Judge Nowakowski in this court is conducting review, which we don't believe this court is, those standards would indeed apply.
Why would you have an administrative agency who makes a decision and then come to the court and ask us to do original action and not do administrative review? I mean, if you want de novo, that's one thing. On the other hand, you insist that the Elections Board did a good job.
Yes, indeed.
You want us to affirm them?
Yes, we do. And if I gave a perception that we're not looking for administrative review under Chapter 227, I apologize. If this Court indeed invokes its original jurisdiction and exclusively invokes that to the exclusion of the Circuit Court, indeed, in determining whether the Elections Board made a reasonable discretionary decision, this Board would be conducting APA review in that sense. But that would be after the invocation of original jurisdiction, allowing the Court to set aside the Dane County proceeding in its entirety and then turn to the standards of review that all agency decisions are subject to. And in this instance, the Board was thoughtful, deliberate, considered the statutory provisions that presidential electors that are independent shall list electors from the various congressional districts is clearly directory under the authority of Algrim. The doctrinal distinction, the bright line rule, what you do with papers versus what you do to them. These are simply listings that are made by either the candidate, the campaign, or the petition circulators themselves.
I have to stop you a minute because you're confusing me. You said that in original jurisdiction, we don't accept any facts as true. And then you say if we accept original jurisdiction, we go to 227.57. But 227.57 clearly says we can't change the facts of the board unless they meet a very high standard, which nobody's argued to us they don't meet. The facts are stipulated, so it's probably a distinction that has no difference in this particular case. But what I hear you now saying is, we're exercising our original jurisdiction to step into the shoes of the Circuit Court and do a 227 review of the board's decision. Is that what you're telling us? So that we void their actions and now we're standing as the initial Chapter 227 review of the board's decision?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Indeed.
I kind of lost me on all.
Yes, and I didn't state that precisely. When I said talking about, and I said that very, with a one-sentence answer to the Justice's question, what we're suggesting is this court is entitled to, and this goes to the transcript of the board hearing, this board is entitled to, once it invokes original jurisdiction, to review all of the documents, pleadings, records, facts, and files before it. That's what I intended to say.
So we're standing in the shoes of the circuit court, and we would review the record at the board just as the circuit court did with what the circuit court currently had
yes,
before it.
Yes, that is our position.
Okay, thank you. I think Justice Prosser may have had a question.
Two questions. Christian M. Meyer of Phelps, Wisconsin. How was he designated as the elector from the 7th District?
Yes, so it's an undisputed and stipulated fact that Mr. Meyer was listed as an elector from the 7th Congressional District, but indeed was not. There was a redistricting several years ago, and Mr. Meyer fell within the 8th Congressional District. And that was a function of the Nader campaign and the people who expressed interest in being electors for him, Justice Prosser.
Well, but the reapportionment was 20 years ago. Vilas County has been in the 8th District for 20 years.
I'm not certain about that.
I want to know the process by which Christian Meyer was the designated person from the 7th District.
That would have been a function of the Nader campaign when people expressed interest in being electors so that such that the nomination papers could be prepared. They designated Meyer as an elector from the 7th Congressional District, and that was a mistake.
Okay.
He is not.
Now, Mr. Nader asked to substitute Kurt Hubach.
Yes, sir.
Does that happen?
Yeah, well, whether it has happened as a legal matter is in dispute. I suspect that respondents will take issue with that. But indeed, there was a letter request by the Nader campaign to substitute Mr. Hubach for Mr. Meyer. And the board, based on its ruling, accepted the substitution. But, of course, the respondents will take issue with the timeliness of the substitution, et cetera. We believe it's entirely proper to remedy an irregularity in a nominating petition by such substitution. In fact, Section 7.75 explicitly provides for post-election substitution at the unilateral control and direction of the electors, meeting on the first Wednesday after the second Monday of December in Washington, D.C.
Apparently, the Nader campaign interpreted the statute as requiring residence in each congressional district.
Well, the residency requirement is just is non-existent.
But I know that's your position, but all the other electors do reside in the district in which their names appear. Is that right?
I believe that's true.
And the statute says there should be two electors from the state at large. If you don't need the electors from reside, and I'm using it to mean reside in the district, what's the point of having two at large?
Well, there is a point to it, and it's ceremonial, as Counsel Dunst advised the board, as Attorney General Balistrieri argued. What we have is a determination of how many electors Wisconsin will send to the Electoral College Nominating Convention, and that's determined by census, and we have 8 because of 8 congressional districts, so it's ceremonial.
I understand that, but it is a legislative requirement, or it is, you would prefer, I say, a legislative directive.
If the state legislature had intended to impose a residency requirement, they would have done so by imposing a residency requirement. If I could just segue into the 775, they're allowed to come back in and unilaterally replace. And that statute does not require that the replacement be a resident of that congressional district.
Or even therefore, use the word from. I understand that.
So that would, and I know your red light is on, but I just wanted to, we got into this subject. So if an elector is named and he or she would die or they move out of state, clearly that would be taken care of by that particular statute, correct?
Yes, and for other cause, unspecified. And this is significant in our view. Who would determine what other cause means? The unilateral sole discretion of the electors convened. There's no provision for review of their private unilateral decision. And if the Wisconsin legislature thought that this was a residency requirement when these electors are listed, they would have surely provided that that convocation of the electors would have to replace the elector who couldn't serve for cause with somebody from that district that resided in the district. And they have not. And, of course, the Wisconsin legislature absolutely knows how to impose residency requirements. The entire statutory schema is built in significant ways on residency status. The word might appear thousands of times in the statutes.
Counsel, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. And I understand your position is there was substantial compliance and the Elections Board had discretion.
Yes.
Mr. Ballester.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning, and I, Justice Abramson, you thanked the parties for their efforts in this case because of the tight deadlines, and I would like to thank the court for its great cooperation in this case. A meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning, I think, is almost unprecedented.
We were here earlier.
I am here representing the Elections Board, and my purpose here is not to either support the candidacy of Ralph Nader or to argue against the Democratic position. My purpose here is to defend the decision of the Elections Board, which actually consists of two different parts. First, the Elections Board believes that the statute that we are considering here today does not require residence as a qualification of a presidential elector. First of all, if you look at the statute, the word residence does not appear. There is no form of the word residence. Many other statutes, constitutional provisions, specifically require residence as a qualification when the legislature wants residence to be a qualification. This statute doesn't say that. So what we have to do is interpret this statute. We have to interpret the words which do not include the word residence to determine whether residence is, in fact, a qualification of an elector. The only word in the statute from which a residency requirement can be inferred is the word from. One of the meanings of the word from does indeed have a connotation of residence. I'm from Milwaukee. I'm from Madison. That has the connotation of I am a resident of Milwaukee or I am a resident of Madison. But there are many, many other meanings of the word from, which is a function word, that don't have the connotation of residence. And I think one of the ones that is most important is, as stated in Webster's On a Bridge Dictionary, the word from can have the meaning of from as an emissary or representative from a political entity. So,
but to the council, I have a question on that. That was the issue that was stumping me. How is that important in this case? Where in the record is there any evidence that this particular elector was an emissary from the district? As I understood council's argument a moment ago, this is an individual who was designated by the campaign.
That's correct. And, in fact, all electors are designated by candidates. They are not elected by the voters in any particular congressional district.
And I understand that, which brings me to my question, then why is emissary from relevant?
Why is the more important question, I think, is why is residence important? Why is it important that the elector who is not elected by people in a congressional district, who in the purely ceremonial casting of the electoral votes in this building in December doesn't cast the votes, doesn't convey those votes that were cast by the person in the district that he is designated to represent, but the votes of the people of the state as a whole for a particular candidate. Why is residence important? It's not.
Well, would you accept that all of these people came from Illinois and had Illinois residence and post office addresses? I mean, if it's not important,
as
why
a legal
did it
matter,
have to be from Wisconsin?
Yes, as a legal matter, there would be no problem with having 10 electors from the state of Illinois. As I explained in the brief, this is a ceremonial requirement.
But you want Wisconsinites as part of the ceremony.
It is certainly preferable to have Wisconsinites represent. I'm sorry?
It would be politically incorrect.
It would be more than politically incorrect. I think it would be political suicide not to name people who were Wisconsin residents and not to name, if you possibly could, not to name people who were actually residents of that particular district.
But pushed to its logical conclusion, you would say that the elections board would view it as not, that the elections board would view it as substantial compliance if these people came from outside the state.
Well, I'm not sure. No, I can't say that. I can't say that the elections board would view it as substantial compliance.
Right, yeah, logical extension.
You asked two
argument.
Different questions.
Okay.
One is whether the statute requires it.
Right.
That's one answer to that question. Whether the elections board would view it as substantial compliance, I rather doubt it.
I accept that. Your position is that this is substantial compliance rather than absolute compliance with the statute?
Yes, of course.
Substantial compliance?
Yes.
Okay.
But we first have to get to the question of what do they have to substantially comply with and why? And I've given you the legislative history of this statute. I've pointed out that in the proposals in 1965, There was a proposal to actually elect presidential electors from each of the congressional districts, and there was in that proposal a requirement that these presidential electors be a resident of that district. That bill never passed. It was never enacted into law. Instead, the legislature basically continued the existing system, which is that presidential electors constitute one composite elector from the state as a whole, not individual electors from the districts, but one composite elector. They are elected by the people from the state as a whole, not people in individual congressional districts. And at the meeting of the presidential electors, they vicariously cast the votes, not of the people of the particular legislative district, but each one of the electors undifferentiated casts the ballots of the people of the state as a whole. And I think
Mr. Balistrate.
Yes.
This is a most fascinating discussion, but was this discussion engaged in by the elections board?
No, it was not.
Was there any discussion about legislative history for
this? No. Election? No, there wasn't.
Did anyone ask whether legislative history was important?
There's no indication in the transcript that was discussed.
Well, I read a question. Is there any legislative history on this in the transcript?
I read that.
What I think I want to hear from you, sir, I mean, other members of the court might want to hear different things, but are we entitled to look at this transcript if we take this as an original action?
If you take this as an original action, you are entitled to look at anything that you want to look at. And I think you are entitled to look at this transcript for other reasons, too. If this action was originally brought as a 227 action in the circuit court. It was a judicial review of an administrative decision. Ordinarily, The agency whose decision is questioned has 20 days to file the record. That didn't happen in this case because of the short time limits, but ordinarily the board would have been entitled to submit this transcript as part of its record. It has done so in other cases.
Whose obligation, if we're talking about that, was there an obligation for the board to get it there? Was it whose side should have had that in front of the judge? I'm talking about the transcript that Justice Prosser
read. Under Chapter 227, it is the obligation of the administrative agency to submit the record, which in this case would be the board.
Yeah. But your position is the time.
My position is that with the time limit, they simply did not have an opportunity to do that. I can personally testify to this court that the members of the board have been working substantial amounts of overtime this past week trying to get the ballots in shape to get them out to the forms, at least out to the county clerks. When I was in here on Saturday talking to Kevin Kennedy, I went down to the board's offices on the third floor of our building, and every single person who is employed by the elections board was in there on Saturday working on these ballots. So they just didn't have time to get this transcript out in time for the hearing on Monday in the circuit court. But had we gone through the ordinary time processes, the board would have been entitled to submit that transcript.
I have another question, and you talked about substantial compliance. Now, I've got the administrative, let's see, it's chapter ELB 2055, and it says, where any required item of information on a nomination paper is incomplete, the filing officer shall accept the information as complete if there has been substantial compliance with the law. My question is, does this phrase refer to all of these nomination papers as a whole? In other words, substantial compliance is where they substantially complied with all of the requirements, or is it individually that, look, there is this requirement, this particular issue we're dealing with, electors, and they named seven that were in these congressional districts. They didn't name the eighth. But is that what we're talking about as far as substantial compliance?
I think so, yes. The board rule that you're talking about is based on this court's Almgren case, which essentially says that insofar as things which go into the nomination papers are concerned, all of the statutes dealing with what goes into the nomination papers are directory rather than mandatory, that only substantial compliance is required, and that the board has discretion to determine whether there is substantial compliance. So that applies to everything that goes into the nomination papers. It does not go to substantive requirements such as the number of valid signatures that are required. It just goes to the form of the nomination papers and what is contained on the form of those
papers. In other words, if they had filed 1,999, that would have been different than that's what you're talking about.
That's correct. If they had filed less than the 2,000 required signatures, that's a substantive requirement. Substantial compliance doesn't apply to that kind of requirement, and the board would have to reject those papers.
I'm referring primarily to the Algrim case, which
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Counsel, I don't understand why this isn't a little different than the Algrim case. And I know that the board in its memo, the council's memo, says, hey, look, there's no clear authority, statutory or by case, to answer these questions of whether or not someone must reside in the district for which they are designated. But I look to the nomination papers that we have before us, and I point out this language that it says, we, the undersigned, those who are signing these nomination papers, ask that people be placed on the ballot for the November 2nd election. so that voters will have the opportunity to vote for their presidential electors listed below. Now, that's unlike the nomination papers filed for circuit court or for other things where the voters will vote for the candidate listed below, you know. Here, the nomination papers, because we're talking about electoral college and that process, and on the face of the papers, it says, so that voters will have the opportunity to vote for their presidential electors listed below. So since that's the purpose as set forth on the face of the nomination papers, why is it incidental? Why is it not substantive in this instance?
Because it's simply a listing on the nomination papers of the names of candidates. This is no different than a situation. It's no different than a situation in which a candidate, for example, would misspell his or her name on the ballot.
And I see that different. I mean, this wording to me has. What's the purpose of this? What's the purpose of, why are we even here? Why are we talking about these 10 people or this one person who's listed? And why are they even listed here in a presidential race? Well, I don't know, but let me see what the nomination paper says, because that answers it. It says, so that we, the undersigned, can vote for the electors listed below. If that's the very purpose of them signing this, then why is it like they didn't dot an I or cross a T?
Because they just made a mistake in putting down the name of a particular elector on the nomination papers. And as I pointed out, actually, they don't. People don't vote for those electors.
So what these people are told in the nomination papers is incorrect?
It is technically incorrect. We have somewhat of a dichotomy between what the statutes say and what reality is. Reality, and I'm talking about reality as defined by this court. The reality.
careful. So in other words, you're saying that those who sign these nomination papers, although it says they're signing them so that they can elect the presidential electors listed below, hey, that's not really what's going on here, and you're being fed a line. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly correct. They're not voting for those electors. They're voting essentially for the candidate who has designated those electors. And since those electors are absolutely bound to vote for the candidate. It's not like in the old days, you know, when the founding fathers established the Electoral College, the idea was that they didn't trust people to make a good decision as to who they should vote for president. We didn't have TV, we didn't have radio, we didn't have newspapers like we have now. We don't have the Madison edition of the New York Times. You know, we just didn't have that back then. So what the idea of the Electoral College was that people would vote for neighbors in their vicinity that they trusted to cast a vote for president.
Council.
That system is long gone.
Council, let me just ask, and I know your red light is on, if I may have permission,
yes.
Chief. Let me just ask you the question that I asked Mr. Bernhoff. Assuming now that your position is one of substantial compliance, once again, where in the record is there any indication that that was the standard relied upon by the board? When I read the letter order that comes out, it reads, the board also found that the candidate Nader's nomination papers complied with the requirements of Section 8.20. And I know there was discussion of substantial compliance in the actual hearing, but when it came time for the vote, it was an up or down vote. So where in the record do we find that?
I have to candidly concede to you that you can't find it anywhere in the record. And this is something that I addressed in my brief, which is that I think this court has to give the board a little bit of leeway that it would not give to other administrative agencies and would certainly not give to a sentencing court in terms of stating its rationale on the record. And one of the reasons is that the time constraints that the board has to operate under, that other administrative agencies don't face, that sentencing judges don't face. There's a very short statutorily specified time between the primary election and the general election. There's a very short statutorily specified time in which the elections board has to certify the candidates to go on the ballots so that the ballots can get out. And because of that very brief time, the elections board simply can't engage in the luxury that other agencies can engage in writing a full, in some cases, what amounts to a court-type opinion, setting forth all the factual findings, the law, the rationale. I do work for some other boards too, and I can tell you that in many cases, some of the professional disciplinary boards write 20, 25-page opinions by an administrative law judge that really set it out more than most judges do. The board simply doesn't have that luxury. They have a very limited time in which they can make their decision, and they have to make it in a hurry. They simply don't have the luxury of doing what other administrative agencies do. And
Counselor, I have to interrupt you because your red light's on, and I have some questions that are bugging me. Were you present at the board hearing when they...
No, I was not.
Have you read the transcript?
I have read the transcript, yes.
Okay. And you find nothing in the transcript that talks about Section 8.30 and that there's an opportunity to use discretion under...
There's a mention of that. There's no question that there is a mention of that. There's also a mention of that in the memo that I attached.
The memo we've had for a while, the transcript I got last night about 10:30 and read... and so your position is there's nothing in here to show they exercise their discretion, even though the board asked both counsel on both sides of it whether 8.30 had any effect, and they talked among themselves about whether they have ever exercised discretion under that statute before, but that, in your opinion, doesn't really show that they exercise their discretion.
That's not exactly correct. What the question that I was answering, which the way I interpreted Justice Butler's question is there something specific in the transcript or in the or in the order of the board that we can pinpoint that shows that the board in fact determined to exercise discretion? And I can't point to anything specific in the transcript.
Okay,
but I absolutely agree with you that if you look at the transcript as a whole, if you look at the fact that the board heard from all interested parties at length, that the board discussed this among themselves, that the board mentioned the question of their discretion and substantial compliance, that one can infer from that transcript that they in fact exercised discretion to determine that there was substantial compliance. I just can't pinpoint something.
Okay, I understand you better. Thank you. I have one other question that's bothering me. You made a mention, though not enlarged very much, about whether you could really constitutionally interpret this statute as requiring residency from all of the electors. And I think your argument was equal protection, and then we got briefs from the amicus, which talks about First Amendment concerns for the voters who have First Amendment concerns that are at issue in this case, aside from what this may mean to Mr. Nader or not. Can you tell me, if I were to look at this statute and how it may or must be interpreted, what constitutional standard do I apply to it?
Well,
Kalkowski applied a rational basis, and my question is that the correct standard?
At this point, I want to make it clear that we are certainly not arguing that the statute is unconstitutional.
I understand.
We're simply arguing that if it is interpreted in one way, it raises some constitutional issues.
Right, and that was my question
now,
also.
The constitutional issues that it raises relate to very fundamental First Amendment rights. And I was not my intent to go into this in detail. My intent was simply to pose the problem without attempting to offer a solution. But I think that the amicus is absolutely correct, that these are fundamental First Amendment rights that are involved here, and if the court were going to consider the constitutional issues, compelling state interest standard would be the one that would be applicable.
Thank you. Now, straight. I don't know if Justice Prosser completed his questions. Justice Prosser, do you?
No,
are you fine? A couple of things quickly. What is the nature of this proceeding before us, in your opinion, counsel? You knew, huh?
I have to honestly tell you that I'm not sure, because I did not file a petition. I was not involved in filing the petition, and these are questions for Mr. Bernhardt to answer. My view of it is that it is a request for the court to take original action and issue a supervisory writ to the circuit court.
And what would be, is this, even if it is an original, if it is an original action, is it still a review of the election board decision?
I think ultimately it is.
All right. And the scope of that review is?
With respect to the issue of statutory interpretation, there are two issues. One is the statutory interpretation. I believe the court's review is de novo, since this is the first time the board has ever had an opportunity to.
No deference to.
So no deference to the board on that. But on the question of substantial compliance, that is a discretionary function of the board, and the standard of review on that would be the typical standard for discretionary decisions, which would be erroneous exercise of discretion.
And that's under 227.57.
That's in 227.
And, yeah. Okay. And substantial compliance for the board comes under what, 8.31A?
That is the statute that deals with it, yes.
That's what you're relying on?
Yes.
All right. One other question. As a practical matter, and I don't know if you know this, Mr. Balistrieri, the statutes have timetables for the ballots to get into the hands of the clerks.
That's correct.
And what is the latest time that they need a decision in order to meet those statutes? And don't tell me yesterday.
I can tell you yesterday as far as the board certification of electors, but under the statutory scheme, the county clerks are supposed to distribute ballots to the municipal clerks on the 31st day before the election, which is Saturday. The municipal clerks are supposed to send out absentee ballots the 30th day before the election, which is Sunday.
Any time extensions because of the weekend?
That's not clear. It's not clear in the statutes. The board does interpret that as meaning Monday is the deadline for both.
Thank you. So it would be Monday and Tuesday in order to do it in a series.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri.
Thank you.
Lester A. Pines, Attorney Pines, representing the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and the individual named.
May it please the court, I very much appreciate the time and effort that the court has put into this matter already. But what I'd like to say is that this court should never have been asked in the first place to have proceeded in this on an original action. The odd thing here is that the parties were aware when Judge Nowakowski made his decision that he had made a final decision. And the parties in court were prepared, win or lose, to appeal the matter. Judge Nowakowski heard this matter on Monday, considered it for 24 hours, reconvened on Tuesday, made a detailed written decision which he had written out and he read into the record, and that's been provided to you. You can see that Judge Nowakowski did a very complete analysis of the law, which the respondent, Democratic Party, and others agree with it substantially. what the Nader campaign is asking you to do is really quite extraordinary. It's not a question here of an original action that has been instituted during the pendency of a circuit court matter. And I would refer the court to the case of Thompson versus Craney, which started in the circuit court, and after the matter was briefed in the circuit court by one of the parties, Governor Thompson filed a petition for an original action, which was accepted by this court, and then this court took original jurisdiction and continued the case to a decision. But in that case, the circuit court had not entered a final order, had not decided the case. Basically, what the Nader campaign is asking here is to get two kicks at the cat, to fully litigate the matter in the circuit court, and when they don't like the decision in the circuit court, to file an original action petition in this court and ask this court to do the whole thing all over again. That is not what an original action is supposed to be. In the case, the Swan case, the court made clear when it was talking about the various jurisdictions of the appellate court and this court and the circuit court, made clear that there are two courts which have the opportunity to take original jurisdiction in a case, the circuit court and this court. Once the circuit court has taken jurisdiction and finished the case, this court can't, under claim preclusion principles, start the case all over again with the same parties and the same question and do it over again.
But counsel, I would normally say, well, that makes sense to me. I mean, it's not original if it's already been completed someplace else. But your opposing counsel then says, okay, so I'm asking you to void the proceedings below. Wipe it off the slate. Let's pretend it never happened. And now, if you void it, you can be original. Do we have authority to do that? How do you respond to that approach?
I think there is a procedure for doing that. It is called an appeal. I've never heard of a litigant coming before the Supreme Court on a request for an original action, and the request for relief is void everything that the circuit court did and start over. There is no precedent for that. There is no statute that allows that. The Constitution doesn't provide for that. What is allowed under the original jurisdiction sections of the statute are two things. One is an original action. Two is a request for a supervisory writ. Now, admittedly, the pleadings had to be done quickly in this case, but it is quite clear that within the scope of the of what was requested here, the petitioner has really asked for a supervisory writ. This whole discussion that preceded my opportunity to speak was about, well, what are we supposed to do? What is the court supposed to do? Are we supposed to do a 227 action? Are we supposed to do some kind of a review? The fact that the court has to even ask those questions is triggered by the fact that this is the wrong court. That if the Nader campaign wanted a review on the merits, they should have gone to the Court of Appeals.
Well, let's just talk about, ask the opposing counsel, what about if we consider this as a bypass? They didn't go to the Court of Appeals, and I talked about, well, mentioned liberal pleading rules. If we would consider what they want the court to look at the decision made, and that's what you do with a bypass.
And that's correct, Justice Wilcox. I just have to say that it would be extraordinary to an extraordinary, unprecedented, and would run the risk of creating a dangerous precedent for a party aggrieved by a circuit court decision to come to this court purportedly asking for an original action and then asking the court to construe it as a bypass, because as we know, to do a bypass, one needs to file an appeal in the Court of Appeals, brief the matter, and then ask for it to be bypassed. But at least one ought to take the step of filing a notice of appeal so that the procedures are followed. And this is not, in my opinion, a trifling matter.
No, I agree with that. I think as I listen to this, this is in the realm of an emergency petition. I'm just asking the reason they might not have gone to the appellate court is because of the time factor mentioned here by opposing counsel and the fact that certain things have to get done. If it went to the Court of Appeals, this would, well, imagine here we're meeting, we met yesterday, we met early this morning, and it wouldn't get here in time. If that's, I'm not trying to put a spin on it, but I mean that's actually what.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But the fundamental point, Justice Wilcox, is this. No one has an absolute right to come to the Supreme Court.
That's true.
That's why the Court of Appeals is there. And we get to the Supreme Court two ways. One, you tell us that you want to hear a case after it's gone to the Court of Appeals and on consideration of bypass, on consideration of certification, or we come and ask for you to take original action. Or we come here asking for an emergency procedure. And the emergency procedure that one would ask for is for a supervisory writ. Now, the statutes do say that you're supposed to go to the Court of Appeals first, but if it's not practical to go to the Court of Appeals, you can come to the Supreme Court. You'll notice in our pleadings, we did not suggest that the writ had to be first directed to the Court of Appeals. The writ is directed to this court. And that's how this court exercises its emergency jurisdiction.
Counselor, how far along the continuum from the filing of the appeal in the circuit court do you think you can go before you're beyond the pale and can no longer file an original action in this court for the same concerns?
After, in my opinion, Justice Rogensack, one cannot ask for an original jurisdiction once the matter has been fully determined by the circuit court.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, when the parties, and I'll take this case as an example. The matter came to the circuit court. There was a request for a writ of prohibition. The parties responded to the petition. They briefed it. They argued it. The court took the matter under advisement. The parties contested only one of the elements. They conceded three of the elements were present for a writ of prohibition. The issue focused on whether there was a substantial probability of success on the merits. The judge ruled. He issued the writ. Everyone agreed that this was a final order of the court. So it was done on the writ of prohibition.
You know, after we got started talking, I'd had someone go over to the clerk's office, and the clerk issued has now an order that your office drafted.
Yes.
That was entered today by Judge Malachowski.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, as I'm trying to figure out the party's positions, if you folks weren't all here, you'd need this order before you could file a petition to appeal the order, correct?
Right. Well, with all due respect, Justice Rogensack, the court did say in the transcript the oral pronouncement would be deemed to be effective immediately. That's at page 19.
And
the reason that the judge did that is just like Assistant Attorney General Ballesteri said about how everyone was under time pressure at the elections board, and, gee, they couldn't put everything into their order. Judge Nowakowski was trying to accommodate the parties.
I understand that, but we look at and I think that was very good of him to do that. I was just trying to square it up with the statute, both in regard to Justice Wilcox's questions and in regard to the arguments made by opposing counsel.
And I understand that. And let me just say this. If the court were to say in this case, well, there's a time gap between the circuit court's order, which he said was effective immediately, and the actual entry of the written order, and where the parties were aware that they were going to go and appeal right away, if the court were to say, well, you can go and do an original action if you get there before the court has entered its written order that it asked the prevailing party to provide, but before he signed it.
But, Counselor, you know, having been an old court of appeals judge before I got up here, if you presented us with that transcript and the order had not been entered, we'd dismiss your appeal if you filed it.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I agree with that. But in this case, the parties were aware and knew that they were going to appeal from the judge's oral decision because the time necessary to circulate the written order for everybody to agree to form would have run out of time. But what I'm saying is that if you say in these circumstances where people are under time pressure, and you give an incentive then for a party to litigate a matter fully in the circuit court, but then run and ask for an original action, that's a very, very dangerous precedent. Very, very dangerous. Because parties can, they will take their chances in the circuit court in these difficult situations and then run up here at the last minute if they've lost there. And that's not how justice ought to be administered in an orderly way.
No, I appreciate the argument. It's well taken.
Mr. Pines, the transcript indicates on 21 in the circuit court that Mr. Bernhoff basically said he wanted emergency expedited review by the Supreme Court.
Right.
If you had been Mr. Bernhoff, how would you have done it?
I can only tell you how I would have done it. I can tell you how we were prepared to do it because we didn't know if we were going to win or we were going to lose when we got there. But we had a docketing statement, a statement on transcript, a notice of appeal, and an order, which we were prepared to have signed. We were prepared to then immediately take it to the clerk of courts to file the docketing statement, go across the street to the Court of Appeals, and ask for an emergency hearing and an expedited briefing schedule, which, as we can see, people can do, and ask the Court of Appeals then to review the matter according to their de novo standard, which they would do, because it would be an appeal on the merits. That's not what happened here. Here, there's this rush to the Supreme Court with a request for an original action, which I think, and I'll reiterate, is nothing more than a request for a supervisory writ. And the implications, as I said in my brief, of asking for a review of a supervisory writ are quite significant.
So is it your position that Mr. Nader has made a procedural error of some kind and we should just throw him out?
No. My position is that he made a strategic decision to come to the Supreme Court instead of going to the Court of Appeals. And he's stuck with that strategy, because the Supreme Court has only the jurisdiction that it has. He asked for an emergency writ of mandamus, which I construe to be a request for supervisory writ. This was a strategic decision. Why it was made, I can't say. But the significance of it is that the review of what Judge Nowakowski did in issuing his writ of prohibition is a limited review. Because a writ of prohibition is an extraordinary remedy. For this court to issue a supervisory writ requires, as the court succinctly said in the Kalo case back in May, that there are standards for review of what the circuit court did. Now,
how could the circuit court make a judgment on what the elections board did without having any transcript or recording or anything of what they did?
The circuit court issued an order. The
elections board issued an order which was dated September 27, 2004.
It was its opinion and order 04-14. That was part of the record, in fact. That was what the Elections Board provided to Judge Nowakowski.
That's that two-pager?
It's a two-page letter dated September 22, 2004. Now,
isn't this a letter to some attorneys?
Well, what it says is, in the last paragraph on the third page, for purposes of subs 5.62 sub 3, 5.61B, and 830.1, and any appeal by any party, this letter constitutes the board's order in this matter. And so what the board did is the board, as you'll look in the, as you'll see in the first paragraph, it says specifically, quote, the board also found that candidate Nader's nomination papers complied with the requirements of Section 8.20 stats, including the requirement of Section 8.20 per 9 stats, that he name a candidate for presidential elector from each of Wisconsin's 8 congressional districts.
But doesn't it also indicate that the board was acting on all the evidence presented and the legal memoranda of its own staff?
What the letter says, it says, after reviewing the complaint and all other evidence submitted to the board, and I'll read this whole paragraph, and after hearing all parties requested to be heard on this subject, and upon the report and recommendation of the staff, the elections board, by a majority of its members present, voted to find that candidate Ralph Nader submitted at least 2,000 qualifying signatures of eligible electors of the state of Wisconsin and did not find that there was sufficient evidence to overcome the staff's verification of the 3,685 qualifying signatures. Then the letter goes on to say the board also found. So, yes, I suppose that one could conclude from that that the board relied on evidence to find that, but I don't know whether that sentence relates back to the prior sentence. But in any case, the board made its determination. Judge Nowakowski, in reviewing the board's...
Just interrupt you for a moment because we have to change the CD in our high-tech system.
We need to go out to American TV, get one of those multiple CD things.
Thank you, Mr. Pines. You may proceed.
Thank you. I did want to also inform the court that the pleadings in this case contain a verified petition, an affidavit of Attorney Geraldine Wendelberger, which provided to the court the board memo. The transcript of the board proceeding was certainly, we had a transcript available which was not requested by anyone, but frankly there were tapes available. If the board had wanted to give the tapes to the judge, the board could have given the tapes to the judge. The board meeting wasn't that long. It didn't need to be transcribed per se. And if you wanted the judge to listen to what people said, it could have given them tapes. There really wasn't an issue here about that, but certainly it was, the board was satisfied with the record that it provided to the court. The board didn't come in, and you can see, the board didn't come in and say, Judge, you can't rule. You don't have enough here. You don't know what
I
really
understand you correctly to say that when you went to circuit court, you had a transcript of the board's proceeding?
We did have a transcript of the board's
but
proceeding. We had prepared it for our own use, yes.
Okay.
But we had not provided it to the court, and the board did not ask for it. Frankly, I don't think the transcript it has any relevance whatsoever in this matter.
Well, it might have helped the judge decide whether the board exercised discretion or didn't exercise discretion.
Well, the board chose not to give the judge the tapes. The board made the choice of what it thought the judge ought to hear. The board was represented by the Attorney General's office. They had every opportunity to provide the judge anything they wanted. And I think the point of this whole matter is it wasn't an issue of how the board acted evidentially. It came down to a legal question. What is the appropriate interpretation of this statute? And that's what the court focused on. That's what the parties focused on. That's what the argument in the court was. And as you see from Judge Nowakowski's very detailed decision, he went through that very, very carefully. That's what the parties wanted him to decide. What does the statute mean, and how did the board deal with it? The problem here, that the problem for this court is, and the reason this court couldn't and shouldn't take original jurisdiction in this case, even if it wanted to, is that it's impossible to create a new record for this court and start all over under the time frames that we're facing. This is not something of the respondents making here. If a candidate for public office waits late as possible practically to file papers, and then there are problems with the papers, and the elections board has to act, and then there are appeals and so forth, and time is running out, that's not something that was caused by the respondents here.
Now, can I ask you, unless we do take this as an original action, is it appropriate for us to consider matters that were not considered by the trial court?
No, it's not. In fact, if you take this, first of all, I think the court should deny any supervisory writ, but to the extent that the court takes it to consider the supervisory writ, all the court reviews is what Judge Nowakowski did to determine whether he had a plain duty and whether he violated a plain duty and what he did.
And that goes back to the procedural question that the Chief Justice asked earlier, is are we reviewing what the circuit judge did or are we reviewing what the board did?
If you take this as an original action, then you're starting over. And you're doing a review of what the board did, and then you are taking up our request for a writ of prohibition. You're not going to the circuit court didn't get to a 227 review because the circuit court took up our request because it was an emergency for a writ of prohibition. So that's what would be before the court in any case here, but our position is that when a writ of prohibition was issued, and in a circumstance like this, all the court can do is decide if it wants to issue a supervisory writ with regard to the circuit court. That the whole notion that you can fully litigate a matter before the circuit court, not like the decision, then run to the Supreme Court and ask for original action and ask for a writ of prohibition is so extraordinary that it's breathtaking, actually. And it would turn the administration of justice in this state and appeals on their head.
How would you explain how this problem, I will use the word problem, came up? I mean, what did the Nader people do wrong?
They didn't do anything in terms of timing. It's not that they did something wrong. It's that the filing of the petitions were done late enough in the process that when there were challenges to it, the time was running. If the petitions had been filed earlier and there were mistakes, they might have been able to have time to go out and correct the mistake. But there was no time left. It was filed. The deadline ran for filing. The challenges were made, and here we are.
Well, now, was there any effort to deceive anybody? I mean, is this anything more than just a sort of a little human error?
I'm sorry,
which
I didn't
part,
hear you.
Which part would be the human error?
Got it.
Is there anything more to the designation of a person from Phelps as the representative of the 7th Congressional District than a little human error?
I can't answer that question. The reason I can't answer that question is it's not in the record. But let me say this about that issue. Our position is that there's a clear statutory scheme for independent candidates. And it's quite easy to become an independent candidate for president in Wisconsin. You need only 2,000 signatures. Compared to other states, this is minuscule. You can get 2,000 signatures in your own neighborhood. Doesn't matter. And all you have to do then, in addition to that, is to show a minimal amount of statewide support. Minimal. You got to name one person from each congressional district, which has 700,000 people in them. All you got to do is say, here's our person from your district. It's a simple statutory scheme, which, incidentally, was suggested by the Attorney General in the Attorney General's opinion, which was provided to Judge Nowakowski, 54 opinions of Attorney General 95 at 1965, where at page 100, in discussing this legislation, the Attorney General said, in part, it would be less disruptive to traditional Wisconsin procedures to amend 5.19 to provide that candidates for presidential elector pledged to independent candidates for president and vice president be nominated one from each congressional district and two from the state at large. And that found its way into the statute with which we're dealing today. And so this is not a trifling requirement. It's a fundamental requirement of how an independent candidate gets on the ballot. What the state has argued and what the Nader candidacy is arguing is that from means for. That the statute, when it says from a congressional district, they're really saying it means for a congressional district. Well, if the legislature wanted to say one elector for each electoral district, they would have said four. Now, I don't know if it was a mistake or if the Nader campaign couldn't find someone in the 7th Congressional District.
Well, let me just say this. I used to go to school in Phelps. My family has a lot of relationship with Phelps. And it wasn't that many years ago that we always, when we sent letters to Phelps, it was Phelps, Vilas County, Wisconsin. And the reason for that, it was always confused with Phelps. So Phelps is about 40 miles from the 7th District, and it's often confused with Phillips, which is clearly in the 7th District.
Yeah, but I would
now,
think
the issue to me is whether that kind of an error is enough to throw someone off the ballot entirely and say to those 3,600-some electors, get out of here.
Well, Justice, I would think that the person who agreed to be the elector would know, A, where he lived, which would be Phelps, and B, that Phelps isn't in that congressional district that he's being listed as being in. And I think a person is presumed, if he's going to be an elector, to know where he lives, what congressional district he's in. But I can't speculate about how this happened. All I know is that the campaign didn't get someone from that district.
But, Counsel, I asked opposing counsel this question about the significance of this, and this is, I think, what Justice Prosser is getting into. Well, what if here an elector, the day this is filed, he dies, or, you know, we talked about Illinois, he moves out of state. There is a, well, I'll just ask you, what about that?
Well, there is a provision for after the election is held, substituting the elector.
So what's so important about this?
Because the legislative scheme is designed so that people looking at the candidacy papers of an independent candidate for president, the people who are being presented with that know that there's minimal statewide support for this candidate, that this candidate was able to get an elector from each congressional district.
Now, you base that on, is that from what history are you referring, what are you referring to?
I'm basing that on the schema of the statute, because the statute sets out in it sets out the requirements of listing your electors, naming your putting a name on your candidacy. In this case, it's called a Better Life. Incidentally, the board eliminated some of the nomination papers that had a different name other than a Better Life. And then getting 2,000 signatures. And that's the statutory scheme that the legislature put together for a candidate. And Judge Nowakowski, in his decision, which I think is very carefully crafted in this on this point, talks about the geographical relationship and the total scheme of what the legislature designed. And it's not designed to make it hard for an independent candidate to get on the ballot. It's designed to make it easy for a candidate to get independent candidate to get on the ballot. I mean, really, the question is, what if they only had 1,999 signatures? Gee, that's just about 2,000.
But we know, I mean, that's been answered. That would be
right. Yeah, that's right. And one of the interesting things is that the board, and Judge Nowakowski noted this, the board has picked and chosen that with regard to those ballots where they didn't have the name right, papers where they didn't have the name right, they threw those out. They don't have the right number of signatures, they throw those out. But this other requirement, they say, well, he complied. And Judge Nowakowski said that's an error of law. And Judge Nowakowski went on to say that even if they had exercised discretion, that their discretion was erroneous because it was based on an improper interpretation of the law.
Was your view that this required compliance, period?
Yes.
Not substantial compliance?
Yes.
What about 8.31a?
Well, this 8.31a and the Algrim case really come together, and I think the Algrim case has been drastically overread by the state, and frankly, I think Judge Nowakowski overread Algrim too, with this notion that it's sort of become like a tagline. Something done with the papers is different than something done to the papers. Well, signing names on the papers is something done to the papers. Getting the signatures done to the papers is not done with the papers. So that is not what Algrim stands for. I think Algrim stands for the principle that non-substantial matters are not going to derail a candidacy, but when there is a substantial, a substantive issue, then the candidate has not qualified. And that is our position. Now, Judge Nowakowski reached the same result. He said that the board had some discretion, but that they misinterpreted the law, which was just another way of coming around and saying, petitioners in the circuit court, you're right on the law. This is a substantive requirement.
Counselor, if I agree with you that the statute has to be strictly read, and if I look at the arguments raised under the First Amendment, Judge Nowakowski looked at that, but briefly, though I think he looked at it under a Fourth Amendment contention, and he applied rational basis. Do you believe that's the correct standard that we should review that argument under?
I do believe it's the correct standard.
Why?
Because we're talking about the things that are being compared are candidates. What are the requirements for an independent candidate? What are the requirements for parties? Parties have drastically different requirements, but the requirements for independent candidates are not so onerous that they so overburden the purported speech that is being a candidate that an independent candidate can't reasonably be expected to get on the ballot. And this,
Mr. Pines, I have to ask you because I have some of the same questions that Justice Rogensack has. It's not just, as I understand it, the right of the candidates. It's also the right of the electorate
right.
to choose.
Well, number one, the electorate, even if Ralph Nader isn't on the ballot, people want to vote for Ralph Nader, they can still vote for Ralph Nader. They can write Ralph Nader's name in. Nobody is being disenfranchised. Nobody is being kept from voting. Nobody is being kept from voting for Ralph Nader.
Does that really square with the Supreme Court's opinion in Anderson versus Calabresi?
Well, I'm not prepared to discuss that in detail, Judge, but let us say that the right of a candidate to get on the ballot cannot be, and the right of voters to consider candidates cannot be unduly burdened. And this statutory schema, as the way we believe that it exists and the way Judge Nowakowski has held that it exists, are minimal burdens at best. The 2,000 signature requirement is minimal, and the requirement to name one elector in each congressional district is extraordinarily minimal. And so I don't think there's any constitutional question that's raised at all by this statutory by these statutory provisions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You indicated at the very beginning that you substantially agreed with Judge Nowakowski's opinion. What don't you agree with it?
We don't agree that the board had any discretion at all accept the ballot, accept the candidacy if an elector had not been named from each of the districts. And Judge Nowakowski believed that they did have some discretion, but that they erroneously exercised their discretion.
In what way erroneously exercised the discretion?
That they proceeded under an improper interpretation of law, as I read his decision, the improper interpretation of law was that the board said that they could find that a party substantially complied with the provisions requiring the naming of an elector from each district, and that was the erroneous view of the law.
But they had no discretion.
They had no discretion.
Did it in a roundabout
right.
way.
That's correct.
You went to circuit court.
Yes.
And you went on appeal from the September 21st
yes.
decision under 227.
Yes.
And what did you view as the scope of review by the circuit court?
Well, the scope of review would have been to review the administrative it's the standard scope of administrative review under 227.
57.
Yes. Right.
But, that's it.
But
right.
then we also asked for writ of prohibition, which is what the court actually considered. And if I could, I want to provide Judge Rogensack with a citation to a case that was decided and to the court. It was decided on September 22, 2004, and the opinion was published by the Seventh Circuit on September 29th. It's case number 043183, Ralph Nader et al., plaintiffs, appellants versus John Keith, K-E-I-T-H et al., defendants, appellees. And it's a very, very good discussion of the constitutional issues with regard to ballot access that the Seventh Circuit just issued.
043183, is that what you're
saying? 043183.
And it's Seventh Circuit.
Seventh Circuit, it was just issued yesterday.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And it's a very detailed discussion.
So they granted the writ, the circuit court granted the writ of prohibition, not the administrative review.
That's right.
Your position of the Nowakowski. Therefore, your position is that it was the writ of prohibition that is being appealed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what the judge ordered, the writ of prohibition. And they could have appealed that writ of prohibition to the appeals court and gotten a de novo review, but instead chose this action and asked for a supervisory writ to direct the court that it was wrong. And having asked for that, they're stuck with the standards that this court set out in Kalel for doing that. And our position is, applying those standards, this court cannot overrule Judge Nowakowski's decision. Because applying the standard to that, Judge Nowakowski did not violate a plain duty, and as I set forth in my brief, and did not violate the law in such a way that this court can issue a supervisory writ. Just cannot do it. It's the wrong writ, and it's the wrong place.
Do you want to say anything else, Mr. Pines?
Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you so much.
Hear none. Thank you, Mr. Pines. Mr. Bernhoff, do you have a few moments in rebuttal?
Thank you.
Thank you. First, I believe there's been some misapprehensions of fact and procedure, and I'd like to clear those up right away. First, with respect to Judge Nowakowski's decision, there was no question that Judge Nowakowski held these provisions about signing electors from congressional districts were merely directory. Second, there is no question that Judge Nowakowski held unequivocally that the board was invested with broad discretion to construe those directory provisions and under 830 sub 1 to do justice and to allow the people, the electors of Wisconsin, to express their political preferences. What Judge Nowakowski's decision turned on was a mere technicality, and the Chief Justice's question is extremely well taken. When Judge Nowakowski said that the board applied the wrong legal standard, what Judge Nowakowski said that meant was that the letter from Board Chairman Kennedy omitted the word substantial. Judge Nowakowski did not hold that the board did not have discretion to find substantial compliance, and that transcript is absolutely crystal clear on that fact. And this is an important distinction, because that is not about the appropriate legal standard. Here, the appropriate legal standard, according to Judge Nowakowski, is discretion. And the board applied discretion, but Judge Nowakowski says they abused it by omitting one single word from a letter from the board chairman. That is an extraordinary holding. It's incomprehensible, frankly.
But isn't that one word an important word? Because the import of the decision is that there was compliance, and unless we accept your position, should we find there was noncompliance, then Judge Nowakowski's decision would be correct, would it not?
Yeah, Justice Butler, to hold, as Judge Nowakowski did in the trial court, that based on all of the argument, the transcript of the elections board, and all of the back and forth adversarial give and take, that somehow the board, it would be a reasonable for a reviewing court to look at all of that and say that the board said that the petitions actually complied, is just incomprehensible. It was stipulated by the parties before the elections board. There was a verified petition. We didn't even file a verified answer because there were pure questions of law. There's extensive discussion in the transcript of this. We stipulated that the petitions were technically defective. We conceded that Nader failed to list an elector from the 7th Congressional District.
Counsel, that's different from Mr. Balestrieri's position. So you are at odds with the state with regard to whether or not there had to be a representative who resides in each district. You're saying that is the requirement?
No. There is no residency requirement. It's ceremonial. It's directory. Algrim has not been overread. Algrim is an extremely thoughtful opinion of this court that sets rules.
Counsel, let me, if I may, it seems to me you're saying it's directory, but directory goes to whether or not they should have someone on the ballot, whether or not the impediment, if you will, is substantial enough to kick someone off. Let me use that vernacular. But the threshold question is whether there is a violation of the statute. Now, I understood from your comments that you admit that there is a violation of the statute, but, hey, it's not that important at all. I mean, since it's not important, the board can do what they want. That's what I understood your position to be. Am I correct?
This court has previously held that same thing.
Okay,
this
court. I don't care what we held. I want to know what your position
is. My position is that.
Was there a violation, even if it's technical, but was there a violation of the statute?
We concede that there was a technical defect in the nomination papers and that, indeed, Nader and Cameo did not list an elector from the 7th Congressional District.
And in that way, you are not consistent with Mr. Balestrieri, who says there is no defect. There doesn't have to be a representation from each district. We could be from Illinois, he says. So you're not in sync with him. Am I correct or am I incorrect with regard to that?
I did not understand the Assistant Attorney General to make that claim. We agree with all of the arguments of the Assistant Attorney General and in his brief and at oral argument. We will readily concede there was a technical defect in irregularity in the nominating petitions, and we urge and join the Assistant Attorney General in urging that those were directory provisions under Algrim, These were things that were done in preparing, signing, or executing the petitions. This is an intelligent, workable, doctrinal, bright-line rule that this Court can continue to rely on. Judge Nowakowski said they were directory. Judge Nowakowski said that 8.30(1)(a) granted discretion to the Court. Judge Nowakowski also talked about Section 5.01. And I think in some sense there's been a little bit there's been some cavalierity, if you'll permit me, with respect to some of the arguments and some of the brief filing. Let's be clear about this, and I would urge the Court to consider this. This is an extraordinary circumstance. This Court has consistently, historically, invoked its original jurisdiction with respect to election matters.
And it was appropriately requested, counsel.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice?
When it was appropriately requested.
Yes, we believe that that our petition was indeed a petition for permission to invoke the original jurisdiction of this Court. And the talk about prerogative writs and supervisory writs has been misplaced here. If you read the case law and petition of Heil and all of its progeny, of course the Court can use superintending supervisory writs in aid of its original jurisdiction. But that does not mean the scope of the writ is bound by the supervisory rules. And that's in petition of Heil. It's very clear about that.
Justice, may I ask a question? I understand your red light is on, but my concern is, where is the authority, because you had argued this before, and I still don't have an answer to this, where is the authority that would allow us to strike down as void a proceeding that has been completed in the trial court in order to reach the supervisory writ that you want us to reach here today?
An opinion of this Court, in re original jurisdiction, in re petition of Heil, Barber v. Circuit Court, all of those cases.
Were those not all pending matters?
I'm sorry?
Were those not all pending matters?
Barber was where there was a circuit court pending matter, and it was also a political case, a candidate seeking to be placed on the political ticket. The authority is absolutely unequivocal, and there's no contrary authority.
My question is, which case where there was a final judgment by the trial court do we have the where it was done, where we would have the authority to strike down as void the trial court proceedings?
We believe that Barber stands for that proposition, but let me suggest that I think this procedure in Judge Nowakowski's court has been misconstrued, and perhaps I participated in that misconstruction. Maybe I can clarify it. This was really a temporary restraining order. We can talk about the old prerogative writs, but all those are analogs to modern rules of injunction, prohibition, mandatory injunctions. That's what was requested, an injunction. Now, we use the old words, but effectively, these are injunctions. These are equity powers. And as a technical matter, Chapter 227 contemplates that the circuit court proceeding is still open. All it did was issue a temporary restraining order. That's all it did. The matter still remains open. I would like to address Justice Rogensack's position about Anderson v. Calabresi. Strict scrutiny applies here. There is no question under Anderson v. Calabresi, and I am prepared to discuss that, that strict scrutiny is the applicable standard when First Amendment voting rights are at issue. That is the rule of the U.S. Supreme Court in Anderson, and the state must demonstrate a compelling state interest.
Counsel, where in the transcript, if you know, does the board discuss substantial compliance?
I was at the proceeding. Current counsel for the respondents was not. They had Quarles and Brady and other lawyers down there in Brookfield, Wisconsin. There are some attorneys at the table who were participating at that hearing. Substantial compliance was discussed liberally throughout the proceeding. I am not prepared to cite page and transcript line number, but it was discussed liberally throughout. In fact, the board members queried board counsel, the chairman. They discussed, you know, substantial compliance work here? Does 8.830.1, does that work for us? Do we have discretion? And the board actually articulated other instances historically that they exercise discretion regarding directory provisions. That is in the transcript.
Well, maybe there's a difference and maybe there isn't between discretion and substantial versus compliance. Are there any other questions for Mr. Bernhoff?
Did you ever look at Elections Board rules?
I do not understand the question, Justice Prosser.
In preparing your case, did you ever look at Elections Board rules on what is directory and what is mandatory?
Indeed, we did not. The board has taken a position in other litigation that's a matter of published litigation. They have adopted Algrim as their seminal guiding case, and that was discussed at the elections board meeting. So the board relies on Algrim, and we do too.
The board does have a rule, elections board rule 2.05 sub 5, dealing with nominations, where any required item of information on a nomination paper is incomplete, the filing officer shall accept the information as complete if there has been substantial compliance with the law.
Yes. And we believe that's an administrative reg that basically implements and puts in force and effect the provisions of 830 sub 1A. The overarching transcendent principle of this legislative schema is articulated at 5.01. Except as otherwise provided, chapters 5 to 12 shall be construed to give effect to the will of the electors if that can be ascertained from the proceedings, notwithstanding informality or failure to fully comply with some of their provisions. That's a very unusual grant of specific discretion where the legislature also prescribes the object of the discretion in its opening statute with respect to the entire election code. And then you look at 830 sub 1A, and it's very clear that the board has discretion regarding directory provisions. Judge Nowakowski said their directory board has discretion, but oops, they forgot to put the word substantial in front of compliance, and therefore they did it wrong. That can't stand. The rights of over 100,000 Wisconsin electors and voters are at stake. What happens here is going to implicate the entire national presidential election. The cases speak of the absolute fundamental franchise prerogatives, liberties, and rights of the people, and the political franchise is absolutely, in my view, one of the most important ones, the right to participate in electing your democratic representatives. And that's why, indeed, this court historically has allowed its original jurisdiction to be invoked in primarily election law cases, most recently in Farm Labor Party. This is an extraordinary case. We correctly came to this court seeking its final authoritative determination about a matter publici juris that affects the rights of all Wisconsin citizens and all citizens throughout this country. It's here. It's appropriately here, and it should be here.
Justice Breyer.
Thank you, Chief. I want to follow up on Justice Prosser's question regarding the administrative rule, EIB 205 sub 5. I understood your concession to be that there was a defect in your filings. And what is that defect?
In the nomination papers?
Yes.
The nomination papers failed to list an elector from the 7th Congressional District.
When I look at the language of sub 5, which reads, where any required item of information on a nomination paper is incomplete, the filing officer shall, et cetera, substantial compliance. And I read that in preparation for the proceedings here this morning. I read that in the context of other things they were talking about in the administrative rule. And I thought that this was not a matter of being incomplete, but a matter of error. And so I wasn't sure if 2.055 applied, because it wasn't a matter of you not filling in something. You know, you didn't leave a space vacant. You didn't fail to number the papers or those other kind of requirements. You didn't leave a number off. But rather you made an error, whether it be technical, but you made an error by listing someone as being in one district when they weren't in that district.
I would urge that the administrative rule applies, and the fact that there was a vacancy on the nominating petitions because there was no elector listed from the 7th Congressional District that falls squarely within that administrative rule, and that indeed the paper was incomplete, having not listed an elector from the 7th Congressional District.
So your position is if that was just blank?
No, my position is they failed to list an elector, so the petition has an incompleteness that can be filled.
All right. Well, suppose they had 7th Circuit, a 7th District, and there was no name. No name on the. Suppose that was the fact situation. No name on the 7th.
I think that the board has broad discretion to resolve these sorts of problems. In talking to the board members, formally and informally, they are charged with almost a Byzantine duty of piling through these nominating petitions. And really, there's been a lot of talk about perverse policy results, but to chain this board with hyper-technical interpretations and try and cabin the exercise of its reasoned granted discretion from the Wisconsin legislature, and then in a sort of nitpicky fashion take a look at everything they've done or could have done, really defeats the purpose of having the election board and kind of guts the purpose of the agency altogether. And that's what we really have here, an attempt to elevate formalisms over substance.
Well, if anything goes, why have all these rules?
Oh, it's not that anything goes. Indeed, there are mandatory requirements under Algrim. These petitions have to contain the requisite number of signatures. They have to be filed in a timely fashion in the place. Those are all jurisdictional substantive requirements under Algrim, and Algrim is the definitive case. It's dispositive.
What if you had had 5 names listed in 2 blank spaces? Would that have been substantial compliance under your position?
As congressional electors?
As congressional electors.
You know, I don't know what the ultimate boundaries of the board's discretion are.
4 names, 3 names? At what point do we say that compliance is no longer substantial?
At the point that the board exercise its statutorily mandated discretion to determine when those can be remedied and cured as directory provisions. This is what this administrative agency was charged with. Their decision was thoughtful, reasoned, deliberate, an obvious exercise of discretion in that they were empowered to do. If I could make one last comment about Keith, the 7th Circuit case wasn't in the briefs. Keith is uninstructive. All the Nader people did was argue there that there were the early petition filing deadline was some sort of First Amendment violation, and is completely uninstructive with respect to the merits of this case.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wish to say one more short sentence today. Not our usual paragraph sentence.
We would urge the court to accept our petition to invoke its original jurisdiction and to protect the rights of the people to the franchise. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much to Mr. Bernhoft, Mr. Balistrieri, and Mr. Pines, not only for excellent arguments this morning, but for their cooperation with the court in meeting various deadlines which the court had to set, because there are other deadlines in this matter. So we thank you all for appearing today. If you had to change other plans for trial or other matters, we apologize to you. And that concludes our hearing in 04-2559W, State of Wisconsin, ex rel Ralph Nader and Peter Camageau versus Circuit Court for Dane County. Court is adjourned. The court will reach its decision when it reaches its decision.